Welcome to Solder Smoke, a podcast about homebrew electronics and amateur radio. This is a program for people who like to melt solder and build their own rigs. For other episodes of the program, go to www.soldersmoke.com. For the latest Solder Smoke news, go to soldersmoke.blogspot.com. Please send feedback to n2cqr@yahoo.com. So, as we step away from our soldering irons and oscilloscopes, please join us for another edition of Solder Smoke. All right, good morning. It's Saturday. Yeah, Saturday, August 29, 2009. That makes this Solder Smoke 114, number 114. Sorry for the delay, guys. Summertime stuff. You know how it is. It's a busy period. We've had some really great visits. My mom was over here with us for a while. Our niece was here from Miami, and been doing just a lot of tourism, having a lot of fun, not a lot of time for melting solder or making solder smoke. But I'm going to try to get a short solder smoke out, because I know some of you out there are starting to twitch. I'm getting these emails: Bill, I need a dose of solder smoke. All right, here we go. We'll give it a shot. Let me give you a little bit of Italy travelogue. A lot to report. The tourism has been fun, I guess, but not for the faint of heart. And you'll see as I go through what I mean. The weather's been really pretty rough here in Rome this summer. It's been an intensely hot summer. We've had weeks on end here where the high reaches 95 every day, 35 Celsius for those of you in the modern world. It's real hot. And lately it's turned hot and humid. It's supposed to cool off here a little bit in the latter part of August, but that's not happening so far. It's going to be a hot one today also. And that's another reason I think not a lot of solder smoke has been melted. The when it gets real hot, the air conditioner here in the I0/N2CQR laboratories doesn't quite keep up. And you just don't want to add to the high temperatures by getting the soldering iron and all test gear going. So anyway, when the fall rolls around, we usually return to the bench and start building stuff, and I hope to do that this year. One particularly hot day, it was our niece Brianna was here, and it was her last day with us, and there was a few things that she had not seen. She had not seen some of the really most important tourist attractions of Rome: the Palatine Hill, the Capitoline Hill, the Roman Forum, and the Colosseum. So Billy and I decided to take her out and show her the sights, and it just happened to be in the midday period, and the temperature was approaching 35 centigrade, 95 Fahrenheit. Man, like I said, tourism, not for the faint of heart in Rome. But we had a great time. We saw the sights, took her into the Colosseum, walked through the Roman Forum, climbed up onto the Palatine Hill. Great stuff. But all very civilized. Now we shift to a more rural kind of summertime adventure. And I might have mentioned in earlier shows that we have a place out, a summer place that we rented out in an area known as Sabina, the Sabine Hills, north of Rome. This is a legendary area. Legend has it that the original Romans back in Romulus and Remus times, 2,700 years ago, they had a real shortage of women in town. And the story is that they went out to the Sabine Hills and kidnapped a whole bunch of them, brought them back to Rome, according to legend. According to the Roman legend, the ladies said, no, no, we want to stay right where we are. Of course, this fits in with a lot of stereotypes. I think the Romans are quite proud of that story. We'll leave it at that. But anyway, that we have our place out there in the Sabine Hills, and it's a beautiful area. And it gives the kids the opportunity to get out of the big city and out and enjoy some of the real countryside living. And it's out in the sticks. It's It's actually in the center of a pretty large olive grove. And we're aware that we went out to the country. Well, you're in the country, and there's wildlife there. But this last trip out there, we were exposed to kind of some kinds of wildlife and an intensity of wildlife experience that we had not really been prepared for. Our first morning out there last weekend, Elisa and Billy decided to go for a walk, and they were about 20 meters out of the front door when I heard this bit of commotion. And what happened is they'd come across a really, really big snake. I mean, you don't think of this in Italy. It just doesn't seem like this is the kind of place where you'd be encountering really large wildlife. But man, the snake must have been 6 feet long, and it must have been, 2, 3 inches in diameter. Big green thing hissing at them. Wow, it was really exciting. Later that morning, we consulted with the locals and discovered that they're harmless. There are some poisonous snakes here, but they're smaller and black in color. And you got to really watch out for them, because those little guys, they can do you in. But this big green one, scary looking, but not really dangerous. Okay, well, that's the first part of our story. Now comes the really exciting part. Billy and I decided we're going to camp out. We have a little tent out there. We set up the tent not too far from the front door of the house, because, well, I want to be kind of within audio range of both the folks who are sleeping in the house and Billy in the tent. So we set up the tent out there in the front yard of the house and get a little campfire going, and we're doing the whole camping out thing, and Billy and I are feeling really, really proud that we're going to rough it and camp out. Elisa and Maria come out to visit us for a while, and we're sitting there, and we're sitting all around the fire, and we're telling camping out stories, and good old time is being had. It's just about time for the ladies to return to civilization, to the house, and leave Billy and I out there to rough it in the wilds, when all of a sudden we hear, just beyond the tree line, the distinctive snorting sound, the deep snorting sound. In the States or elsewhere, you'd think this was just a pig snorting, but we knew what it was. It was Cingali. Man, wild boar. You guys ready for this? Wild boar. You guys aren't familiar. Some of you guys sitting there in cities, some of you sitting there in San Francisco and New York City, those kind of places, London. Go to the website, go to Google, and just type in there, wild boar, and take a look at some of these fellows. I mean, enormous. I mean, like small motor vehicle sized animals these things are, with big, ugly tusks. Now, the other thing about wild boar is usually when you do this kind of Google searching for wild animals and you try to find out if they're dangerous, there's usually a few lines in there about how this animal will not bother you unless you bother it. They always put the guilt trip on the victim, the person who's been gobbled up by one of these wild animals. With the wild boar, they don't even say that. Even the animal lovers, even the pro wild boar community out there, doesn't go so far as to say, if you don't bother them, they don't bother you. The furthest they'll go is they'll say, the wild boar will only attack if surprised or disturbed. So in other words, if you disturb him a little bit, he just might go off. Man. Anyway, I'm sorry to say, I'm kind of ashamed to say that we wimped out. Well, I wimped out. Billy wanted to stay out there, but having grown up in an area where we didn't have wild boars, I figured that discretion was the better part of valor, and I figured we better retreat to the house and do some Googling and find out more and talk to the locals to see how much of a threat these beasts really are. And we've come to the conclusion that, well, we're going to risk it. So this weekend we're heading back out to Sabina, and Well, if you don't hear any further solder smokes, you'll I guess you'll know what happened, but we think it'll be okay. And so Billy and I are going to make another attempt at camping out in the Sabine Hills. All right. That's our Italy travelogue for Solder Smoke 114. Hey, Maria asked me an interesting question, and I thought I'd share this with you guys. You know, a lot of times from the mouths of babes, you know, we were sitting around, and Maria, sometimes she'll kind of furrow her brow, and I could tell she's thinking about something deep. And she said to me, "Daddy, what do you have to do to be considered a scientist?" And I said, "Ah, man, good question." So we started talking about it, and then we started talking about how there's professional scientists, but there's also amateur scientists. I have C.L. Strong's book, The Amateur Scientist. I myself am an amateur astronomer. I suppose at a certain level that makes me an amateur scientist. But what this made me think about was, if we have amateur scientists, and we talk about amateur scientists, and we use that term all the time, but very rarely do you hear somebody describe somebody as an amateur engineer. But I guess that's what a lot of us are. We are. I guess we're amateur engineers. I mean, a lot of you guys are also professional engineers, but a lot of us who are just hacking away at this stuff, I guess we could be considered amateur engineers. Now, it may be that people are averse to using that term because I guess it conjures up images of, you know, bridges collapsing and buildings falling over because they were put together by amateur engineers. But I'm thinking that we should kind of start using this term more, amateur engineering. Now, there's a kind of a variety of this that you do hear, not too often, but from time to time, self-taught engineer. I always think that's pretty impressive, especially when the guy involved has come up with something really, really good. They don't say he's an amateur engineer. He's a self-taught engineer. I guess most of us are self-taught. I guess we're self-taught amateur engineers. There you go. What would the acronym be? STAA. STAE. Yeah. We're STAEs. Self-taught amateur engineers. Three cheers for us. All right. I hope that generates some thought and discussion. Gentlemen, I've returned to whispering. I'm whispering again. You know, I go back and forth here on the whisper or visual MEPT issue. For those of you who are not involved in this madness, there's, you know, we're doing these really low power, really slow, low and slow beacon transmissions. My transmitter, I guess, like most guys, is on 30 meters. The idea is you bring the power level really, really down. Mine's at about 20 milliwatts. And you bring the transmission rate really, really slow also. I mean really slow. Like I think I'm doing each dit is three second dits. There's two ways you could do it. You could do visual, in which case the receivers look for a visual pattern and paint a visual pattern on the screen. And there are, around the world, grabbers set up that will automatically record what they're receiving and put it in graphic form up on the web. So if you've got your visual MEPT or manned experimental propagation transmitter going, you can visit the website of somebody who has an online grabber out there and see your signal. For example, I can get my signal up at a grabber in Belgium. ON5EX has a grabber up there, and I can, whenever I have my visual beacon on, I can go to Johan's site and see my signal arriving at his station and being decoded by his software, and I can see the display that he sees on his computer screen. It's all pretty neat. Now, Whisper is significantly different. It uses the same low and slow principle, but it's based on software, special software that encodes it, and so anyway, it doesn't. You don't get a visual display, but receiving stations automatically report having picked up your beacon, and then it's displayed on the whisper page. There's a little bit of, I think, friendly antagonism between the visual guys and the whisper guys. I really like the whisper thing because you get up in the morning and you go to the screen and you can see where your signals have been received, and it's not just a matter of going around. With the visual thing, you have to, you kind of have to be there when the signal is being received, whereas the whisper system will record which stations have received your signal, and you could take a look and see who's picked me up over the last 12 hours, 24 hours, whatever you like, and you could have it displayed on a nice, neat Google map. So I recently made the switch back to Whisper, and it's been a lot of fun. I have crossed the Atlantic a few times with the 20 milliwatt signal. I'm really tempted, I don't think I'm going to do it, but I'm really tempted to take the beacon transmitter out to Sabina and set up a proper antenna out there, get this thing going, and really see if I can I can be received worldwide with this crazy little beacon transmitter I have. By the way, my whisper transmitter, I have to say, I believe is unique. It is the only double sideband beacon transmitter in the world, and I'm usually one of the lowest powered stations on the system, because when you look at the whisper screen, you can see the power levels that people are using. Some guys are using 20 watts. Come on, fellas, that's that's not whispering. But anyway, at 20 milliwatts, it's quite fun. So anyway, we've been having fun with that. I'm whispering again and enjoying it. What else did I mention? Oh, the station out there at the in Sabina, I have the HW8 out there, and I have been using it. I brought my logbook back here. Got to remember to take it out to the field with me again. But okay, it's kind of interesting. I get up in the morning out there, and some of the stations that I've worked. I was the other morning listening to 4X4BL and 4X4WN chatting away on 20-meter SSB in the morning, talking about good old Collins gear. And I could hear stations in also on SSB, JY4CI. Last time we were out there, I worked some stations on 40 meters. I worked I1ULJ, and I heard IZ3DV with IZ3DVW beacon on 40 meters. Let's see, who else? I've been having fun with the station out there in Sabina, and I hope to fire it up and work a few more stations. I also had the telescope out there, and I have the telescope out there. I've been doing some Jupiter observations, which is very timely, because we just passed the actual 400th birthday of the telescope, and of course Galileo was the man. I guess it's the 400th anniversary of the astronomical use of the telescope, and Galileo's big target was Jupiter, which of course is why we talk about Jupiter's Galilean moons. And we've been watching them from Sabina. Sabina is only 1 hour north of Rome, but even at that distance, the skies are dark enough to see the Milky Way. I mean, I'm sure that real serious amateur astronomers would not consider this a dark sight, because when you look off to the south, you can definitely see the glow of Rome. But it's dark enough to see the Milky Way, which is something that really you could never see when you're in central Rome. So from an astronomical point of view, it's fun. I have the telescope out there, and we have some friends who are going to be out there with us this weekend, and I hope to do some sidewalk. Well, actually, I guess it would be Olive Grove Astronomy. We'll show the other folks some of the astronomical sites. Last weekend or weekend before, we braved the heat and went to the Flea at Trastevere, as I'm calling it. This is sort of a variation on the Flea at MIT. Man, it was way too hot. And, you know, one thing else I should have mentioned on the uh, on the travelogue section, Rome really shuts down in mid-August. There's a week here around a holiday called Ferragosto where, man, this place just closes up. I mean, you have a tough time finding food stores open. It's really a bit ominous. Everybody leaves, and the city is sort of left to the tourists and the homeless. I'm exaggerating, but sometimes it seems that way. And but the flea market was still in operation, so Billy, Elisa, and I went down there. Maria sensibly decided to stay in the air conditioning with Grandma, but went through the flea market. The only thing I found was an old U.S. Robotics 33K dial-up modem, which of course I had to buy because I'm going to use it with the old Toshiba Satellite Pro PC with the ridiculously slow Pentium chip in it that I've been refurbishing. Jeff KO7M is helping me out with this project. Thanks again, Jeff. And this is, I guess this is a symptom of the neck. You just can't let go. People who are more kind of computer guys than neck guys don't seem to understand this. And when I talk to the computer guys at work about my efforts to restore some of these old computers, they just don't get it. And they say, just throw the damn thing out and buy a new one. They don't understand. If you have the neck, you don't want to do that. You want to fix the thing. And it's so somehow it's offensive if this thing which worked before stopped working. And I don't know. I guess it's part of kind of rebelling against appliance operatorism. But even though this computer is hopelessly outdated and at best it's going to run Windows 95, and it's really almost an antique status. There's some useful things that I could do with it. So anyway, I plunked down 10 euros and picked up the US Robotics modem, which might work, and we'll keep you posted on this important technological move into the on the cutting edge of 1995. I mentioned my mom, she was here. One thing she does for me is she keeps me subscribed to a really fine magazine, which I mention from time to time, Air and Space. Man, from the Smithsonian's Air and Space Museum. I love this magazine. It's got a lot of common ground with NAC victims here. And one of the really interesting articles, let me see if you guys want to pick it up. What issue is it? It's the August 2009 issue. Great article in here about electric airplanes. Now, we're not talking about electric model airplanes. We're talking about real electric airplanes with electric motors in them. Very interesting stuff about, and it's an interesting technical article about the challenges of using electric motors in airplanes that'll carry people. And a lot of it gets down to sort of issues of energy intensity, gasoline versus batteries. And it comes down to the fact that, well, you get a lot more energy in a pound of gasoline than you do in a pound of batteries. But they've also got some interesting calculations here. 1 horsepower equals 346 watts. So 1 kilowatt equals 1 1/3 horsepower. So I guess some of these QRO guys could really kind of blow the minds of their QSO partners there by saying, yeah, I'm running the Yaesu or Icom or Kenwood here and running right now I'm running about 1 1/3 horsepower. Quick, somebody do some QRP calculations. If 1 kilowatt equals 1 1/3 horsepower, how many horsepower are we running at 5 watts? How many horsepower am I running with my 20 milliwatt beacon? I don't have the calculator out, but I leave that to you guys. These are the kind of important issues that we that we face here at Solder Smoke. All right, what else? Another magazine. Wanted to bring something to read out to Sabina last week, and so Elise has been reading about quantum physics, and she's really gotten interested in it. And so there were the New Scientist Weekly of 15 August 2009 has on its front cover, "What Space Is Really Made Of." When light from a distant galaxy arrives 4 minutes late, something mysterious is getting in the way. Guys, this is a cool article for knack people like us, for radio guys. The New Scientist, by the way, is one of my favorite magazines. I read it every week in London, and I considered it one of the nicest fringe benefits of being the science officer at American Embassy London, which I was. And so this thing would come in every week. I think it's frankly a lot better than Scientific American. I hate to say that because I like Scientific American, but I would say New Scientist is better. Not only that, New Scientist is a weekly, man. They got to knock this thing out every week. You know, Scientific American's a monthly. When I was in London, I had a chance to go out and visit the offices of the New Scientist and talk to their editorial staff. Great fellows, really interesting people, and I was really envious. What a cool job to work at the New Scientist. Anyway, in their 15 August edition, there's an article in here about called "The Light That Came in Late." And what they're talking about is, they're talking about these gamma ray bursts that they know are coming from very, very distant galaxies. And what they've discovered is that for some reason, the photons that come from these very distant explosive events, some of them, depending on the frequency and the energy level of the photons, arrive to Earth significantly late. And this is leading them to believe that things are not as simple as we had assumed. And let me see here. Let's see. I'll read you a bit of it. On the night of 30 June 2005, the sky high above La Palma in Spain's Canary Islands crackled with streaks of blue light too faint for humans to see. Atop the Roque de los Muchachos, the highest point of the island, though, a powerful magic eye was waiting and watching. MAGIC, the Major Atmospheric Gamma Ray Imaging Chernikov Telescope. Man, these guys have a way with acronyms. MAGIC scans the sky each night for high-energy photons from the distant cosmos. Most nights, nothing remarkable comes, but every now and again, a brief flash of energetic light bears witness to the violent convulsions of a faraway galaxy. Ooh, yeah. That's where I want to work. I want to work in the magic place. What MAGIC saw on that balmy night in June came like a bolt from the blue. That is because something truly astounding may have been encoded in that fleeting Atlantic glow. Evidence that the fabric of space-time is not silky smooth as Einstein and many others have presumed, but rough, turbulent, and fundamentally grainy stuff. Yes, there you go. We're back to the ether. I always suspected that, you know, when Michelson and Morley got rid of the ether, I don't know. I mean, I'm really an amateur category here, guys. But okay, we got rid of the ether, but we still say that free space has distinct, quantifiable electrical characteristics, permittivity and permeability. The permittivity and permeability of free space. Okay, but there's nothing there, right? Okay, there's nothing there, but the nothing stuff has permeability and permittivity. All right, check out the New Scientist article. This is real good food for thought. Great stuff. All right. Oh, I've been thinking about kind of knack-related maladies. You know, we talked about dial parallax and the other things you can suffer. I forgot one. Ground loops. Yes, Mrs. Dilbert, we're sorry, but young Dilbert is suffering from ground loops. And another one, because I walked home with one of these things in my pocket the other day. Altoidism. Yes. QRPers are definitely more susceptible to Altoidism. all right, I mentioned Galileo's birthday, or the Galileo, the 400th anniversary. Google marked the event with a really nice symbol there with the telescope. You know, we've gotten lots in the recent, many. It started, I think, with Tesla. Google had one of their drawings for Tesla. Then they did Orsted, and then the most recent Galileo. There are obviously some NAC victims in the Googleplex, and three cheers for them. Great going, folks. Really have enjoyed the drawings. That's really good. All right, now, got to tell you a tale of woe, and man, this, I'm sure you guys will sympathize. We use the internet service provider here is an Italian company called Fastweb. They usually do a pretty good job, and for the first 2 years that we were here, man, that connection never dropped. 2 years, rock solid, really great stuff. Little modem box there, the little ADSL modem box blinking away, never gave us any trouble. All of a sudden, that modem died. You guys may have remembered, I think I was knocked off the solder smoke internet circuit for a while. Well, they came out and replaced the box and seemed to work for a while, but then it started dropping out. And the problems really got worse when we were right in the middle of this Ferragosto period where nobody in Italy was working, so it got really frustrating. You know, there's obviously a problem with the modem box. I had a bit of a tough time convincing the Fastweb folks that the problem wasn't on my end. We eventually did, but you know, I just got to tell you a story. I guess this shows you the dangers of having the knack. Because it was so frustrating. This thing was broken. This little box was sitting there, and it looked like the thing was just dropping out. Now, I knew that the electronics in that box was just devilishly complicated way beyond my ability to fix it. I knew that if I opened that thing up, I would find a PC board with a few chips, each of which had about, you know, 400 little leads sticking out of it. But I couldn't resist it. You know, the thing was broken. I suppose if the tech told me that he was going to come and replace the box that day or the next day, it'd be okay. But I knew that it would be at least a week or two. And I said to myself, man, maybe I can fix this thing. Hope springs eternal. You know, and these boxes, they're not supposed to be opened up, you know. But I figured out how to open the thing up. They had the screws were hidden under the little feet on the bottom, you know, little feet to keep it from scratching the table. I popped the little feet off, and also there were the four little Phillips head screws. So out they came, and I opened the box, and there's the board. And I start poking around in there. And the way this thing would fail is it would work for a while, working just fine. All of a sudden, boop, all the lights go out, including the power light. The whole thing just shuts down, and then it reboots. Then it works for a while. You know, intermittent failures can be really frustrating. But if it's involving your internet connection, having it work intermittently is better than having it not work at all. Because at least we could watch, you know, use the internet for a while. And we just got used to dealing with these kind of frustrating dropouts. But it was getting us really irritated. So I said, okay, let me go in there. Now it's intermittent. Now I start thinking of theories. What's wrong with it? Maybe, I don't know, it seemed kind of thermal. It seemed like something in there was getting hot. So I put my fingers on the chips, and one of them, even though it had a heat sink on it, did seem to be getting a little bit too hot. Aha! I thought, man, I got it. Ooh, this is great. I'm going to fix this thing. I'm going to get out my tube of heat sink compound, and I'm going to just slap on the top of this dinky little heat sink that they put on there, and I'm going to put another one in there, and I'm going to just, you know, cool this baby down, and maybe that'll solve the problem. And I did, and I put it on there, and I put the heat sink on top, and man, I fixed it. I was so happy with this thing. I'd been exchanging emails with our friend Ron Sparks down there in Dubai, seeking his words of wisdom on how to fix this thing. And I put it on there, and I wrote this really long email about, you know, my heroic efforts to fix the ADSL modem, and I was just, and I said, and I concluded with a triumphant, and I fixed it, and I used my NACS instincts, and wow, I am so proud that even with this technology that I can't understand and don't have a circuit diagram, and it's all this digital stuff, the old NAC instincts came to the fore, and I was able to fix it, and I was just about to hit the send button, and it dropped out. Oh, man. The thing, boop, the lights go out. I didn't fix it. No, 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 it wasn't thermal. All right, okay. So now I start thinking it's a voltage thing. I noticed that the board that they have in there, you could just see where the company in China or wherever they put it together really was trying to kind of pinch pennies. The heat sinks weren't that good. The construction wasn't all that great. And you could see places on the board where they originally had some parts but then decided, well, maybe we can do without them. And it looked to me like there was a voltage regulator chip in there that had been, you know, decided that they didn't. It was one of those things where they decided later on that they could save some a little bit of money by doing without. So I figured, well, let me mess around with the voltage supply a little bit here. It wanted, you know, 15 volts regulated, and let's see if I give it really give it a nice 15 volts steady regulated voltage. See if that helps. Again, I thought I had it, man. Oh yeah, I was big. Oh, I was running around telling Billy and Marie and Elisa what an electronic wizard I was, and I fixed the ADSL modem. And then all of a sudden I heard from the other room, Daddy, the internet dropped out again. Boom. Shut down. All right. Maybe I should stick to QRP transmitters and discrete components and analog and all that. Elisa used her diplomatic skills and convinced the FastWeb guys to come on over, and they sent the tech over, and they changed the box, and all is well with the internet. But, well, look, I tried, okay? I guess I'll console myself and say that's the important thing. Hey, another thing on the list here. Some blasts from the past. Sir Douglas Hall. You know, Sir Douglas, and, you know, one of the many things I like about British society is I really like it's a strange thing, but I like the honorific Sir. Now, our British listeners will know what I'm talking about here. American listeners are probably not too familiar with it, but, you know, when you get knighted in the UK, it's a big deal. It should be. It's a great honor. When we were in London, I had the real privilege of living right next door to Sir Jeremy Morse. And Sir Jeremy is a really distinguished figure in the world of British finance. Morse, by the way, he is related to Samuel F.B. He also, those of you who know about Inspector Morse was named for our neighbor, Sir Jeremy. Great guy. And the thing is, it seems the whole Sir thing, the whole knighthood thing can seem sort of very elitist. But the way they do it in the UK is when somebody is knighted, you don't have to. It actually allows for a little what seemed always seemed to me a bit more informality, because once the person is knighted, he's almost always referred to by Sir and the first name. So in other words, you would never call somebody Sir Morse. You really even you don't really have to say Sir Jeremy Morse, but it's Sir Jeremy. And so every time we saw him, which was almost every day when we were in London, good morning, Sir Jeremy. Oh, good morning. Billy really got into it too, because the whole knight thing, you know, the queen with the sword on the shoulder, it was really great. Anyway, I really like the way the Brits use the honorific Sir, which brings us to Sir Douglas Hall, because there was a QRPL message about Sir Douglas Hall. And so Sir Douglas passed away in 2004. I remember I was in the UK when he passed away, and his obit in the British papers included this great picture of him sitting there with one of his electronic inventions. Sir Douglas was a British diplomat, colonial official, worked in Africa for many years, and apparently was greatly admired by people in the areas that he worked in and administered. He was apparently a very compassionate person, and had a very distinguished career overseas, working for Her Majesty's government. And his obituary is, it's really interesting. I put it up on the blog. You guys can check it out. And apparently, the whole time he was out there, he was suffering from the knack. And man, he was building stuff in faraway places. And I really kind of identified with him, because the whole idea, the whole diplomatic thing, and dealing with the knack while far from home and in out of the way places, it's an interesting story. I put the article about him up on the Solder Smoke blog page, so check it out. Also, there's a short excerpt from one of his articles in which he describes the circumstances under which he was building stuff, and then I have a picture of him there, sort of as an older man with one of his radio creations there. I also have a link to a website with all of the articles called "The Ingenious Circuits of Sir Douglas Hall." Check it out, great stuff. I mean, global knack, solder smoke, the global adventure in radio electronics. Sir Douglas. Well, three cheers for Sir Douglas, and thanks for the folks on QRPL who reminded me of his wonderful work. Another bit of history. This one not quite so uplifting, but interesting. I have on the Blogspot page I guess one of the more alluring titles that we've ever had on the blog. You'll see it. It's probably caught some of your the attention of some of you already. It's called "Sonia Had the Knack." Now, guys, forget about it, man. This is a family show. So when we say "Sonia had the knack," we're talking about, radio stuff, that kind of knack. It's an interesting article sent to us by Stuart G3YSX, and he wrote this article for his local radio club newsletter a while back, and I thought it was real interesting. Sonia was a spy. Sonia was a Soviet spy, and apparently, Soviet spies from the GRU really had to have the knack, because when they were sent out, they were under instructions to build their radios on their own with locally procured parts. And Sonia did, and Stewart's article describes some of the radios that she made and some of the trials and tribulations of being a radio spy home brewer. I guess of being a spy radio operator without the ability to use appliances. Anyway, really interesting. I've got it on there. There's a second part to the article that I hope I plan on putting up on the blog too, which gives more technical details on the circuits used by Sonia. All right, let's see. I've been rambling on here longer than I thought. Holy cow, I thought this would be a short one, but we still haven't even got to
time for
Solder Smoke Mailbag.
I love them.
Indeed.
Okay, all right. Solder Smoke Mailbag. Early on, got a really nice email from a listener in Canada, one of our younger listeners, Ashke, up in VA7 land. Ashke is 15 years old, man, and is doing great work in homebrew electronics. And he'd been trying to get his hands on solid state design for the radio amateur, and was having a tough time with it. He was getting sticker shock. You know how it is. You go out onto eBay and it's $150, $200, $250. We've discussed the possibility of selling our 401ks and investing in SSDRAs, but Ashke, he was looking for another way, and intrepid guy that he is, he found it. Remember, the library. Yeah, the library. He asked his local library about SSDRA. I don't know whether they had it or they had it in the system, but they got it for him. And he got a notice, and he said that he ran down to the library. After he got the notice, he ran down to the library in fear that somebody would check out SSDRA before he got to it. But he got there in time, and the library got him the book, and he's I imagine right now he's pretty much memorizing it. So anyway, I'm glad that Ashke came up with that solution, and I hope you get as much information and understanding out of SSDRA that the rest of us have. Thanks for sharing that with us, Ashke. Ray, KO4RB, writes in, and he recently ordered Solder Smoke the book from Lulu and was really impressed with Lulu's delivery service. So thanks for letting us know about that, Ray. I hope you enjoy the book. John Spriggs wrote in commenting on Hackerspace and Linux, and he says that he points out that there are these Hackerspace areas popping up all over the world, including in the United States. He also provides some information on some Linux sites and blogs. Thanks for that, John. Okay, you guys know that I'm bad with Scandinavian names. I've messed up a lot of them, and I'm gonna guess here it's Jogir, J-O-G-I-E-R. I'm sorry if I messed that up. Jogir, L-A-1-N-O-A. He writes in that he listens to and plays Solder Smoke while building radios, and really thanks for the nice feedback there. And let me know if I got your name wrong, and I apologize in advance. Alan, K6ZY, another Pacific Northwest QRP Club co-conspirator. Yeah, we're calling them that, co-conspirators. There's something going on up there in the Pacific Northwest. Alan suggested that maybe we call the group a coven or something like that, but sounds like great stuff is going on out there, and he's having a good time with the group and with Solder Smoke. Let's see, Mark KA9OOY commented on the mystery sounds in last week's episode. He says it sounds like tapping on telephone supports. And by the way, he points out that tapping on telephone pole supports is the source of the blaster sound in Star Wars. Some of you guys are probably fans, I'm guessing. Maybe even some of you could possibly have watched a few Star Trek episodes, if I'm not wrong. Anyway, Patrick sends that in. Thanks for that. And thanks for the greetings from the cornfields of Indiana. Great stuff. Bill Carver, W7 Alpha Alpha Zulu, was kind enough to send me a real nice audio filter coil with a cap across it that'll hopefully help take care of some of the whistling S sounds here that we've discovered are not in the circuitry, but are in fact from my voice. We'll give it a shot, Bill. Once the temperature drops here a bit, we'll get going with that one. And thanks very much for sending that along. Simon, G0FCU, has read Solder Smoke the book in the Swiss Alps. People are writing in telling me all the great places where they've been to, where they read the book. And I'm happy to report that Simon read the book up in the Swiss Alps, and he was inspired by it. And he took his daughters out hiking, and while out hiking, picked up some of his own iron pyrite, and is going to take the iron pyrite and use it for a crystal set. How cool is that? Find your own iron pyrite. Find it up in the Swiss Alps. Get an idea from Solder Smoke and go home and build a crystal radio out of it. Tell us how it works out. Tell us how it works out there, Simon, because I found that iron pyrite worked better than the famed galena. Let's see. Mike Morgan sent in a link to a story about Gene Shepard that you guys who are Gene Shepard fans, will really like this one. Shepard is either you like him or you don't. If you don't go to this website. But if you do like him, or if you're interested and you want to get more of an insight into what a wild scene Shep's life really was and some of the adventures that he was involved in, check out the link that I put it up on the blog. It's about Shep's adventures with his book, I Libertine. You'll really, if you're a Shep fan, guys, this will give you some insight into what Shep was all about. It's not really radio related, although there's a little bit about his early days with station WOR in New York. But check it out. I think you'll really like it. Todd, K5TAK, read the book, read Solder Smoke the book with, as I requested, read it with pencil in hand. And he started his email to me with a quote from the book in which I talked about how, as a young radio amateur, I was taught by my Elmers that a clean signal is almost the hallmark of good character, and that if you had a nasty signal, if you had chirps or drift or spurs or parasitics in there, it was the hallmark of electromagnetic disrepute. Well, he applied that principle to the book and sent me a really, really useful list of typos that he found in the book. And he sent this along with me, and he said that he wanted to kind of improve the signal-to-noise ratio in the book. So one of the great things about the Lulu print-on-demand system is that I can just go in there and fix them, and it'll be of immediate benefit to those who come along and buy the book right after I make the fix. So, hey, Todd, thanks very much. I really appreciate you sending the list. That's exactly what I'm looking for, and I hope that, that others who read the book will follow Todd's example. This is a homebrew book about homebrew radio, and as in all homebrew projects, we depend on the help of our fellow radio amateurs. So I appreciate the help with getting the typos out of there. Alan, speaking of the book, Alan, W2AEW. Alan is one of the guys that we said has one of the coolest jobs for a radio amateur. He's a field service engineer for Tektronix, and he travels the country, helping out with Tektronix equipment. He read the book, not while, I told him, I said, don't read the book while driving, Alan, and he followed my advice. He read the book on the Outer Banks of North Carolina, and he made a discovery about it. People really like the cover of the book. I get a lot of good comments on the cover. People also like the hand-drawn diagrams, and people have told me not to change the hand-drawn diagrams. They like them. But Alan made a discovery about the book and its cover that no one else has made. Alan discovered that a combination of sweat and sunscreen will cause a bit of leakage and running from the ink on the cover of Solder Smoke, A Global Adventure in Radio Electronics. Alan discovered this when his wife looked over at him and said, "Hey, Alan, how come your knees have turned blue?" Anyway, so we have to warn you guys, do not combine sweat and sunscreen with the cover of Solder Smoke, the book. I'll have to alert the technicians at Lulu to this problem, and I'm sure we'll be able to correct it for future editions. But anyway, thanks for that, sending that report in, Alan, and I'm glad you liked the book. Niles, GM, this is another name I'm messing up. I think it's Niles, GM8EUG, wrote in about a QRP to the field situation. An interesting question. You know, in the UK, when you move between the four nations that make up the UK, for example, when you move from England into Scotland, your call sign changes. And if you were, G8EUJ, EUG, or something like that, when you moved into Scotland, you become GM8EUG. And if you move over to Northern Ireland, you become GI8EUG, all that kind of stuff. If you move into Wales, you become GW8EUG. But what do you do if you're on the border? What do you do if you're on the border between England and Scotland, a very important border in the world, an important border in world history? What do you do if the operator is sitting on one side of the border, but his antenna is a cross on the other side. Which call sign do you use? This is a real British question. Thanks for sending it in. Let us know what you guys work out on this one. You see, this is an interesting different in culture. This really, nobody really would really worry about this kind of fine point here in Italy too much. It really wouldn't be, it would just be sort of va bene and would figure it out. But let us know what you work out on this one, old man. We're interested to know. We got a nice email from Wes, W7ZOI. He read the book while on vacation out the Oregon coast and sent a book. He sent me some really great feedback that I'm going to use to improve future versions of the book. I mentioned Stuart G3YSX sending us in the report on Sonia. Mike, KC7IT, wrote in about Solar Cycle 24. There's a website out there called solarcycle24.com. They report that we recently went 47 days without sunspots and report that this is the lowest level of sunspot activity ever recorded. That makes those of us who are going out there with 20 milliwatts even more valiant. Dave, WA5DJJ, he writes in to say, this is part of the whole visual MEPT whisper thing. He says that, quote, I have abandoned the visual MEPT anarchists for the cheap thrills of whisper. Now, he didn't actually say cheap thrills. He said something like for the instant gratification of whisper. But I thought cheap thrills sounded better. So I'm going to say that Dave said to me that I abandoned the visual MEPT activists for the cheap thrills of the whisper system. Anyway, sorry about that, Dave. I tried. And I'll come back. I promise I'll come back. For now, I'm whispering. He points out that the MEPT visual guys need more grabbers. They especially need grabbers in Africa, South America, and Asia. So I posted his letter on the blog, and those of you in those areas might be able to help out and put something up, put some grabbers up there to help Dave and the visual MEPT anarchists. All right, finally, we have a nice letter from Tom, NC0O, and he points out that the books and the podcasts have caused the knack that was long dormant in him to resurface. He spent many years as a professional electronics engineer, and he thinks that those kind of work responsibilities might have suppressed the knack, the hobbyist in him. But I guess he's now reverting to amateur engineer status, and he thinks that the podcast and the book have helped rekindle the interest in this area. He writes, Bill, thanks, I think, for restoring some of the magic of discovery that I felt as a kid when building my own radios, Tesla coils, telescopes, and rockets. Well, thanks for that nice note, Tom. That's what this is all about. Guys, that brings us to the end of Solder Smoke 114. We're heading back out to Sabina. Wish us luck with the snakes and the wild boars. I'll be on the air with the HW8. We'll be pointing the 6-inch Dobsonian Newtonian skyward, probably looking at Jupiter and other things. Have a great Labor Day weekend coming up for those of you in the USA, and 73 from Rome.